Supporting a Strong Man, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has declared war on drug addicts. Some 8,000 people are thought to have died in that war. Duterte's supporters say it's a small price to pay.
In the war against drugs, there will be more casualties. 8,000 is, very small.
Plus, the Turkish satirical magazine that's tackling the patriarchy.
If you're a woman, you can't sit next to a man. Then you are traveling from a city to another city.
And Russian companies building stadiums are starting to get a reputation.
Not paying workers their full wages, or not paying promised wages, or in many cases not paying any wages at all.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Glad you could be with us this Monday. In case you hadn't heard, over the weekend, President Trump upped his battle with the press. In fact, he retweeted a photoshopped video showing him wrestling CNN to the mat. Brian Kloss is a fellow at the London School of Economics. He's the author of the book, The Despot's Accomplice. And he says Trump's assault on the media feels kind of familiar.
It's a tried and true playbook. These borrowing tactics that work at discrediting independent sources of truth that challenge the narrative coming out of the White House, which is something that we've seen around the world in places like Turkey and Thailand after the military took charge in 2014, or in Hungary. And in history as well, this has been a tried and true playbook for leaders who do not want to take criticism. And instead of trying to correct the narrative, they simply try to shoot the messenger, so to speak, and demonize the press. And that's what we're seeing with Donald Trump, is weaponizing that public distrust at the media for his own political gain.
Now, this latest thing, the video of him wrestling CNN, it's a real stunt. And have you seen stunts like this before in terms of creative ways that people really go at the press?
Sure. I mean, there's been examples of despots throwing shoes at journalists and things like this. But this digital media war is new territory, especially for the United States. It's something where a lot of his base will find this amusing. I don't find it amusing at all. I mean, part of that is because I've interviewed many journalists who have been tortured or kidnapped or jailed in authoritarian regimes, and it's not a laughing matter. But more to the point, in the United States, it's that over time, this is not going to go away. When Trump leaves office, there will be tens of millions of people who are not just more polarized than before, but simply do not trust the sources of information that are coming out of mainstream news outlets.
What about the fact that Trump is Trump? He was like this before he was president. He's always going to call attention to himself. Are we taking it too seriously?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Trump has not changed, but now he's the president of the United States and his words carry the power of office. His actions create action in other people. So if he sets the tone that he's going to body slam a journalist, it's not that much of a leap to imagine that that changes the culture. He's setting not just a tone in the United States that is permissive of eroding democratic norms, but also permissive in the world where we're simply embracing despots and strongmen who previously were criticized by the U.S. State Department for the record on human rights. I mean, I don't think if you're a despot abroad, you're looking at Trump's video on his tweet and thinking, you know, if I jail or torture a journalist, the White House is going to call me and chastise me. I think they're more likely to be applauded.
Now, some of Trump's supporters do think that he's been really beat up unfairly by the press, and they love that he's fighting back. And here in the U.S., we're all about free speech. So is there something healthy about this tussle?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a double standard that's happening here to a great degree. I mean, President Obama was accused of being unpresidential at various times for using a selfie stick. And when you think about that compared to what has been happening in this presidency, I don't think this is a healthy change. I think it's a combative change that's going to create a lot of collateral damage along the way. And beyond that, we cannot hold our president to the lowest possible standard. Every president expects that they're going to be part of criticism and sometimes outlandish behavior on the part of celebrities, whatever it is. But that's part of the job. And they cannot simply lower themselves to it because it's part of the gravitas and the credibility of the White House. And we've already seen in the first 6 months of President Trump's time in office, confidence in U.S. leadership in a recent Pew Research survey has fallen in the United States from other countries like Germany by 75%, 70% in France, 56% in the United Kingdom. And so we're being laughed at a lot around the world where they look at this and cannot understand how somebody in the position of the Oval Office is behaving like this.
What's depressing about this whole thing is that here we are talking to you and we're public radio and you're saying all these things and we're talking about how, you know, we're interpreting the story in a particular way and going along the line. But in conservative news outlets, they're doing the opposite. And so if we all keep preaching to the choir, what's the point? How do we get beyond this?
Well, this is why I think, you know, what's really been astonishing to me is where things that used to be absolutely clearly bipartisan are now partisan. And this is one of them. The president of the United States should not send out a video of him pummeling the likeness of a journalist in a wrestling match, not just because of decorum, but because of the signal it sends. They shouldn't say that news outlets are the enemy of the American people. And at the point where those become partisan statements, our democracy is really under threat because those are principles that the country was founded on. And they cannot become Republican or Democrat. That's why it's not about preaching to the choir. It's about saying we have a country that is founded on certain principles, and a free, independent press that is respected is an important part of that. And I think we can't lose sight of that no matter what.
Brian Kloss is the author of The Despot's Accomplice, How the West is Aiding and Abetting the Decline of Democracy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Another leader who's had a tense relationship with the press is Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. About a year ago, when he came into office, Duterte launched a war on drug users.
My campaign against drug will not stop until the last pusher and the last drug lord are...
So far, some 8,000 people are thought to have been killed. Around the world, many see Duterte as a sadistic strongman. But at home, his approval ratings are sky high, about 80%. The World's Patrick Wynn recently met with one of the president's most hardcore fans, a man who heads the Duterte Youth.
First off, Ronald Cardama wants to clear up a few things. No, Duterte Youth was not inspired by the Hitler Youth. Yes, they do wear red armbands, but it's not what you think.
That's from another generation, from another continent, and we're not really trying to emulate that, the one from Germany.
Cardama is a 32-year-old political consultant. He says the Duterte Youth has roughly 10,000 followers online. He tells me, look, you want to know why people love Duterte so much? It's all about bringing order to chaos.
All of us know that it's dangerous to go outside at night. You're scared. Take care, because there might be drug addicts who will get your money and kill you.
Are methamphetamine addicts really seen as, psychopaths in Philippine society?
Yes, like drug addict rapes a one-year-old child. The drugs saturated their brains.
This is a favorite line from Duterte, that meth, called shabu in the Philippines, warps people until they're beyond salvation.
A year or more of shabu use would shrink the brain of a person, and therefore he is no longer viable for rehabilitation.
Experts say that brain shrinking claim is just not true. Still, Duterte has effectively used it to justify police hunting down suspected addicts. In the West, we're reading about nearly 8,000 people killed in these operations, and that sounds like a massacre. What can you say to people who think that your president is a monster?
We have a 100 million population and we have 4 million drug addicts. In the war against drugs, there will be more casualties. Because in any war, there's always casualties. 8,000 is, I think, very small.
This is a woman who spoke to Human Rights Watch. She was not named. Her husband was killed in Duterte's purge, and she says his death is like the loss of a limb. Filipinos hear these stories all the time, usually on TV news, where you'll see mothers grieving their sons. But Cardama says you have to put this into perspective.
It's very sad always to see a mother crying because his son was killed. But there were many Filipinos crying because their daughters were raped by drug addicts. Their sons were killed because of they were going to steal the cell phones.
The UN condemns this drug war, but Cardama says Duterte fans are sick of all the foreign criticism. He says the president feels kinship with a different set of world leaders.
I think he likes President Trump. I think he likes President Putin. I think he likes the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. I think he likes strongman leaders.
His supporters, they don't just dig this tough guy persona. Cardemus says they also like his country swagger. The president calls himself a provinciano, which means a provincial guy, like a hick. He's from a southern island called Mindanao, not the capital. And this plays well in a poor country that's been dominated by elite political dynasties.
He dresses in a simple way. Sometimes he has a shoes that is already needs repair, and he wants to stay in touch with the people.
His recipe for connecting with regular folks, machismo on rocket fuel. Duterte imposed martial law last month in Mindanao. It was an attempt to suppress an ISIS-linked insurgency on his home island. And he told soldiers he'd have their back no matter what, even if they committed rape.
He makes a lot of jokes.
But Cardemus says reporters like me shouldn't take him so seriously.
For example, in a two-hour speech, it's full of jokes. And sometimes in that two-hour speech, there's 1 minute that becomes exaggerated, and that's the one covered by the media. It's a joke about a rape joke or about women, something like that. But if you were there listening to his two-hour speech, you'll discover what's in his heart.
President Trump, who says he supports the drug war, could soon hear Duterte's jokes in person. He's given the Philippine president an open invitation to the White House. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Manila, the Philippines.
Sometimes it pays to step back and look at the big picture. And few people think bigger than British scientist Stephen Hawking. The world-renowned theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and author turned 75 earlier this year.
I never expected to reach 75, so I feel very fortunate to be able to reflect on my legacy.
Since the age of 21, Hawking has suffered from a form of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. He's almost completely unable to move now. And he speaks through a computerized voice system activated by movements in his cheek. In an interview with our colleagues at the BBC, Hawking was asked about a number of pressing global issues, including President Trump's decision to leave the Paris Climate Agreement.
We are close to the tipping point where global warming becomes irreversible. Trump's action could push the Earth over the brink to become like Venus, with a temperature of 250 degrees. And raining sulfuric acid. Climate change is one of the great dangers we face, and it's one we can prevent if we act now. By denying the evidence for climate change and pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement, Donald Trump will cause avoidable environmental damage to our beautiful planet, endangering the natural world for us and our children.
So does Hawking think humankind can evolve and work through its problems?
I fear evolution has inbuilt greed and aggression to the human genome. There is no sign of conflict lessening, and the development of militarized technology and weapons of mass destruction could make that disastrous. The best hope for the survival of the human race might be independent colonies in space.
In the here and now, though, Hawking had one wish for his 75th birthday, a cure for ALS, or at least a way to slow its progression. Coming up, marching across Turkey in protest. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. It's about 280 miles from Turkey's capital Ankara to Istanbul. You could drive it in a few hours, but a group led by Turkey's main opposition party is doing it on foot. It's going to take about 3 weeks. It's a protest against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So far, about 10,000 people have joined the march. Patrick Kingsley is covering the march for the New York Times. He's in Istanbul. Patrick, why did they choose a 3-week trek as a form of protest?
Well, I think they'd run out of other options. This is a party that's traditionally been quite conservative in the way that it opposes the president. But in a situation where you're living in a state of emergency and the president is ruling by decree, I think the opposition party felt that there was no other option than to go ballistic, as it were, and to abandon conventional forms of opposition and go on this very eye-catching march through the heat wave that we're experiencing right now in Turkey of temperatures higher than 100 degrees. Over mountains and now along the flat farmland of northern Turkey to protest the extraordinary crackdown on civil liberties that we're seeing in Turkey today.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what specifically are the marchers protesting?
Well, they say they are marching simply for justice, adalet, the Turkish word for justice. And that's because we're in a situation where 50,000 people approximately have been arrested and around 150,000 have been fired or suspended from their jobs, supposedly for connection with terrorist groups or groups that are formed to bring down the government. But what the opposition party is saying, and what a lot of people are saying in Turkey, is that actually the government has expanded its crackdown that began as a means of containing a coup attempt last year to include people who weren't involved in that coup attempt, but in fact are just involved in legitimate forms of opposition.
Have you been out to see the marchers?
I have. I spent a day with them last week. It's not a very glamorous experience. People are sweating and they've got blisters and bandages on their feet because some of them have been marching since the beginning. Others are joining them every day for that day's marching and they may be going back to work afterwards. And it's interesting seeing the reactions of local villagers as they go through Anatolian villages or towns. Some people are voicing their support or clapping from balconies. Others are very angry about it because they support the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And you see sort of heated arguments at the side of the roads as supporters of the president come to berate the marches. Because while half the country roughly thinks that the president is an authoritarian who is trying to unravel the secular and democratic state, others see him as a protector of the pious majority in Turkey, and they're grateful to him for building better infrastructure, better transport routes, better healthcare, all sorts of things that they didn't feel they had before President Erdogan came to power.
A march like this seems exactly like something the Erdogan government would crack down on. Are the marchers worried about that?
I think people are certainly worried that as the march gets closer to Istanbul, that President Erdogan is going to try and do something to stop them from getting inside the city limits. However, the clever thing for the government to do is just to let it happen, because if the march is allowed to reach its conclusion without a showdown with the authorities, that will prevent people who are maybe on the fence about what's going on from sympathizing with the marchers. If the marchers and their leaders are locked up or tear gassed, then perhaps people who feel a bit conflicted about what's going on might be more likely to sympathize with the people that are trudging between Ankara and Istanbul. Whereas if they're allowed to do their own business, it creates the perception that this is still a democratic society and there's nothing to worry about.
Patrick Kingsley is with the New York Times. He's been speaking to us from Istanbul. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you.
In Turkey, there's a satirical magazine written almost entirely by women. It's called Bayan Yani, which means side by side. And it's a reference to an unofficial rule that's enforced on commuter buses in Turkey.
If you're a woman, you can't sit next to a man. Then you are traveling from a city to another city.
Ezgi Aksoy is one of the founders of Bayan Yani. She says Turkey has a long history of satirical magazines, but in 2011, a rising tide of misogyny highlighted the need for a publication that focused on issues that concerned women.
Women began to feel threatened at work or at streets, especially going out at night was a very big thing. We began to feel threatened, and women began to be assaulted at streets for the reasons such as wearing shorts or even for smiling. It is not a typical thing for Turkey, in fact, because maybe you know, Turkey was never a paradise for women, but Turkey is among the first countries in Europe which granted the rights of women, such as voting or getting selected, etc. So we decided to open this new field and struggle by publishing a magazine, a humor magazine, which is prepared entirely by women. So we did it.
Times are kind of tough in Turkey. As you well know, there was an attempted coup last summer. And since then, President Erdogan has cracked down on all sorts of forms of free expression. He's arrested journalists and at least one well-known political cartoonist. Has that political crackdown affected what you're willing to publish in Bayan Yani?
Of course. It affects most of the opposition here. Most of the time you feel threatened, you feel afraid, maybe. but you carry on, you continue to do what you're doing. It's on a witch hunt here, almost like a witch hunt. They carry on taking journalists, cartoonists, writers, academicians. So it's a complicated time here.
Have you or anyone at Bayanyani been threatened by the government or persecuted?
No, we are not directly threatened. But as a company, Leman, we have been attacked. And there has been some lawsuits against Leman.
And Leman is the satire magazine that Bayanyani is kind of an offshoot of Leman.
Yes, it is. It is also the oldest humor magazine in Turkey right now.
Do you find yourself censoring yourself, like you want to do something, you want to write about something, or a cartoonist from Bayanyani wants to draw something, but then you think, no, we just can't do that. It's too risky.
Yeah, I can't talk about the other people, but yes, I do sometimes feel that I write something and then I delete it. I say, no, I can't write this. I don't want to go to jail. So sometimes, yes, I feel that censorship in myself.
Do you or does anyone at Bayanyani have any protection from a government crackdown?
What kind of protection?
Legal protection or actions you could take if someone did try to...
No. It's like impossible to have a legal protection because... last year, during the COP in July, a group of men, I say 15 men, they marched to our door and they were carrying gas with them. They threatened to burn the building down. We were not at the building. It was night at 3 a.m. or something. And the police were there, but police protected the men with the gas in their hands. So... we don't even ask for protection.
Ezgi Aksoy, one of the founders of the satirical magazine Bayanyani. We've got some choice cartoons from the magazine at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills. A Syrian girl named Dalia flees war with her mother. Now they live in Los Angeles, but Dalia still thinks of home.
My perhaps unrealistic dream is that I want to go back one day and rebuild the Syria that is currently being destroyed.
Dalia's other country, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. If you've used a computer lately, and of course you have, there's a good chance that computer was equipped with security software made by Kaspersky Lab. It produces some of the most popular antivirus and internet security software in the U.S. But this cybersecurity firm is headquartered in Russia. And some U.S. officials have raised concern that the company's CEO may be a little too close to the Kremlin. Rafael Satter is following the story for the Associated Press, so I asked him if there's any solid evidence to suggest Russians are using this software to compromise U.S. computers.
I've not seen any such evidence. There have been questions raised about the loyalty of the founder, Eugene Kaspersky himself, and indeed about the trustworthiness of a Russian company more generally in this field.
Is Kaspersky the only Russian company selling security products in the U.S. on this scale?
I would have to think so. It's very unusual for a Russian company to be popular like this outside of Russia. There are other Russian tech giants. So I'm thinking of the search engine Yandex or the Facebook clone, Kontakte. But those are not or barely used in the United States. Kaspersky, by contrast, you can see it basically at any technology store.
And what has led U.S. officials to be suspicious of Kaspersky himself?
That's an excellent question, and it's one that I can't quite answer. And that's in part because U.S. officials haven't been very clear. When lawmakers grilled them about their reasons for their suspicion of Kaspersky Lab, their answer was to say that that was something that they couldn't discuss in an unclassified setting. So it's the kind of answer that raises more questions than it answers.
Now, lawmakers in the U.S. are weighing a proposal to ban Kaspersky's company from the Pentagon. There's also been reports that the FBI is investigating U.S.-based Kaspersky employees. Is this just the result of heightened paranoia towards Russia?
I think that that's something that Kaspersky and his defenders might argue. I'm not in a position to say. Eugene Kaspersky has confirmed that many of his U.S. employees met with FBI agents. And yes, it's clear that the mood in Congress seems to be turning against him. I don't know to what degree this is based on recent events or whether this has been cooking for a long time.
Now, Kaspersky himself says he's ready and willing to have the U.S. review some of his software source code. Do you think that will be enough to ease suspicion?
I don't know, because some of the suspicion doesn't relate to the source code. There has been concern raised in some quarters that the source code could contain, for example, a backdoor that could do unwanted things to people's computers. There are other suspicions that go beyond the source code. There are suspicions about whether he has former Russian intelligence agents on his payroll, and there are suspicions about whether he might change his company's priorities in order to suit the whims of the Kremlin.
Just last week, we reported on the extensive review process that Russia requires before some U.S. security companies can sell their software in Russia. Does the U.S. do the same kind of rigorous review?
You know, I don't think so. I don't believe that the United States requires, for example, companies to share their source code. And in Russia, the legal requirements in terms of what a company must do if it operates in Russia are far more onerous. But it seems like some U.S. lawmakers want to even the score.
Do you think it's a dangerous precedent if the U.S. goes so far as what Russia's doing, which is reviewing the source code of a private company?
That's what a lot of experts argue. People note that very few companies export to the United States in the way that Kaspersky does. However, the U.S. is a huge exporter of technology products. And so if we start requiring foreign companies to jump through the hoops if they want to deal with U.S. consumers, we may find ourselves staring down the barrel of some blowback in that respect.
Rafael Satter is a reporter for the Associated Press. He's been speaking to us from Kiev. Thanks, Rafael.
Thanks for having me.
We're hearing a lot about Russia and cybersecurity, but Russia is also quietly preparing to host the Soccer World Cup in 2018, and those preparations are controversial. An international labor group says at least 17 construction workers have died working on Russia's World Cup stadiums, and there are reports of widespread labor violations as well. Levi Bridges has the story from Moscow.
A morning train pulls into Begovaya Station in the Moscow underground, and 31-year-old Eric Shakpovich is headed to work.
Good morning. My name is Eric.
Eric speaks a little English. He earned a law degree in his home country of Kyrgyzstan. But Eric left home to do manual labor in Russia. Even with a college degree, he can earn four times as much working on construction projects in Moscow. Eric leads me out of the metro to the construction site at Luzhniki Stadium, where he works. A year from now, Luzhniki will host the opening match of the World Cup. Eric insulated ceilings here at the stadium for 2 months. His boss promised to pay when he finished the gig. But one day, Eric's employer just disappeared.
They said they would pay tomorrow. Then they said it would be next week. And then a month went by and a month and a half, but they still never paid us. The people we worked for just ran away.
Migrants from Central Asia, like Eric, are doing most of the construction work in the 11 Russian World Cup host cities. Eric came to Russia hoping to save enough money to finish building his house, pay his fiancé's family a kolam, that's a traditional dowry in Kyrgyzstan, and throw a nice wedding when he came home. One major problem. Eric's boss never gave him an employment contract. That's illegal in Russia. But Eric says the reasons migrants get tricked by Russian bosses, even for a trained lawyer like himself, are complex.
Kyrgyz, Uzbeks, Tajiks, they're mostly Muslim, and they take a person for their word. So when a boss promises them something, they believe it and do the work. And then at the end of the job, they don't get paid.
Workers at five of Russia's World Cup stadiums have gone on strike over unpaid wages. Other workers said they were forced to work in freezing winter temperatures without adequate protection. And in one case, workers were even arrested and deported from Russia for complaining about the conditions. Jane Buchanan monitors Russia's World Cup construction for Human Rights Watch. She's heard lots of stories like Eric's.
Not paying workers their full wages, or not paying promised wages, or in many cases not paying any wages at all. It's pure exploitation that those kind of practices are tolerated and are the norm.
Many workers at Russia's stadiums said their bosses threatened to fire them for speaking about the working conditions. And workers aren't the only ones who face retaliation. A researcher with Human Rights Watch was arrested and threatened by police for investigating working conditions at a stadium in the Russian city of Volgograd.
The atmosphere of control and intimidation and secrecy was something that we had never encountered before. So there is a real concern for Human Rights Watch what this atmosphere means, what it is that the authorities and those responsible for the World Cup have to hide.
For the first time, FIFA, soccer's governing body, is regularly inspecting labor conditions at World Cup construction sites. And they admit there have been problems. But FIFA hasn't really said what sorts of specific labor violations they've found. I requested an interview. FIFA sent me a brief email response maintaining that working conditions at the Russian stadiums are, quote, paramount.
Ага, все, хорошо, до свидания.
Да, посторонние ехали, и я вас слышу, потом не слышу. Хорошо?
Просто смотрите, вот он как раз сказал про Геннадия Цыганова, да?
Варя Третьяк works with Civic Assistance Committee, a Moscow nonprofit that provides legal aid to migrants. She says this exploitation persists, plain and simply, because many Russians just don't want foreigners here.
People think that immigration, it is something bad for the economy, that migrants take away their job, that maybe migrants can be terrorists.
Varya works to help migrants get paid. Today, she's investigating a construction company that owes a worker from Uzbekistan $2,000.
Yes, in the internet, you can Google.
Varya searches an online database, and she quickly learns this construction company isn't properly registered.
It is illegal to do this in Russia Federation.
Next, Varya uses this information when she calls the worker's boss.
Да, здравствуйте. Это Дмитрий Николаевич Бескровайный.
Варя doesn't pull her punches. She's tough. But the employer says he's never heard of this worker.
Нет, Анарматов Батыр.
Нет, к сожалению.
If this employer won't pay, Varya will find a lawyer to take him to court. But because it's dangerous for people to talk with workers at the World Cup stadiums, most migrants don't even know these resources exist. Eric Shakpovich, the lawyer from Kyrgyzstan, just moved on with things. He went back home to Kyrgyzstan.
У нас есть такая пословица: в гостях хорошо, а дома лучше.
Eric returned home without saving enough money to finish his house. He hadn't even gotten married. The last time we emailed, Eric had decided he was heading back to Russia to work at another construction site. For the World, Levi Bridges, Moscow.
Our next story is about Dalia Zeno. Back in 2012, when she was just 13 years old, she left Syria with her mother. They eventually ended up in Los Angeles. And now her five-year journey has been turned into a documentary called Dalia's Other Country. My BBC colleague Shaima Khalil caught up with Dalia recently and asked her what it was like leaving her hometown, Aleppo.
The war has started and there were shootings in front of my house and it started to become a little bit dangerous, but my parents wanted to leave before it got any worse. I remember just looking through the window on my way to the airport, feeling like it's my last time, but I thought it was just a vacation, but it didn't feel like it. And so I came here to the United States, and I guess I realized that it wasn't a vacation. I am really going to stay here. So I was really scared of what's going to come up next and how I'm going to adjust to this new life of mine.
What was the thing that worried you the most, or the thing that you were most anxious about?
For me to get accepted, honestly, because I started wearing the hijab right before I came here to the United States.
The headscarf.
Yes. I was just afraid of me not being accepted, especially going to high school, because I wear the headscarf.
And what was it like, your first day in school?
God, I was, first of all, I was very nervous. I was very scared. People were confused, especially that I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. They were like, why is this person here? Why is she wearing this thing on her head? Mm. Of course, a lot of people asked me different questions, but I feel like it all came out of curiosity.
And it must have been such a shift. I remember when I moved to Miami mm-hmm. from Alexandria, where I'm from, I'm Egyptian, okay. and I was 9 years old. And I remember just thinking, my God, this is so different. The streets are bigger, they're uh-huh. cleaner, there's greenery everywhere. It's just and I remember being so anxious as well. What were your impressions? Because my God, is it a shift? I mean, tell me about that. Tell me about adjusting, especially in school, because that's a big thing. That's the biggest part of your life.
Yeah, because the school system was so different, I felt like I had to do triple the work my peers were doing. I just felt like I had so much to catch up on. I joined some sports and dance and did some arts because I was very overwhelmed by all the new things that I was seeing, and I wanted to try it all, you know? But also it was a way of me to fit in and try to catch up with what everyone else my age is doing.
Now living in the United States as a Muslim American, a young woman mm-hmm. who wears a hijab, the headscarf, coming from Syria also has its challenges, especially with the election of President Donald Trump and mm-hmm. with things like the Muslim ban, for example, and his rhetoric right. about Muslims during his campaign. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. When you see and hear that, what are you thinking? How does it make you feel? And how has it affected your family?
So many Muslims were so scared, including myself and my mother. And especially women that wore the headscarf really felt threatened. And so in the film, you see my mother wears a hat above her headscarf trying
to hide it
in some way, because she's afraid of getting assaulted in any way or getting criticized for being Muslim. And I did not agree with her because I felt like my hijab represented me. And it was something that I chose to do in my country. And it was like, I'm not going to hide myself and I'm not going to hide my identity. Like, it's the opposite. I'm going to show you that the stereotypes that you are putting on me are not correct. They're not right.
Now, the documentary, the film is called Dahlia's Other Country, which is the United States, I guess. And it examines the idea of home. Deep down inside Dahlia, which country do you call home? The United States or Syria?
Both. I cannot say one or the other whatsoever, because Syria is my home and my foundation and where I came from. But also now the United States is my home and the place where I'm getting so many opportunities that I'm blessed to be a part of, and the place where I'm living in safely and happily, and with the place I love. And I love both places, and they're both a part of me, and I love both parts.
Do you think you'll ever go back?
I really want to go back, but I don't think I would go back to live there. I definitely want to go back to visit. I'm also studying architecture right now, and my perhaps unrealistic dream is that I want to go back one day and rebuild the Syria that is currently being destroyed.
Dahlia Zeno speaking there with BBC's Shaima Khalil. In Diplomacy 101, you learn that an ultimatum is a drastic tool. It's basically one country saying to another, do what we say or else. So a lot of people are scratching their heads over the ultimatum delivered to the Gulf nation of Qatar by four of its neighbors, led by Saudi Arabia. They've set a new deadline for late tomorrow, but it's still not clear what, if any, the consequences might be for Qatar if it doesn't buckle under. Raf Sanchez is in Qatar for Britain's Daily Telegraph. Raf, first off, remind us, what exactly does Saudi Arabia and its allies want from Qatar, and why?
So this crisis among the Gulf nations has been going on for about a month now. It started on June 5th, and Saudi Arabia and a coalition of its allies accuse Qatar of ties with terrorist groups. They say that Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based television network, is inciting sectarianism and extremism across the region. Saudi Arabia wants Qatar to expel the small number of Turkish soldiers that are using a base in its territory. And they delivered these demands to Qatar 10 days ago in an ultimatum. And as you said, it wasn't really clear what the consequences were if that ultimatum wasn't met.
And there is so far no sign of compliance from Qatar, right?
So we've had a flurry of diplomatic activity today. The emir of Qatar has delivered a handwritten note to the leader of Kuwait, who's acting as a kind of go-between and a mediator in this crisis. We don't exactly know what is in that letter, but we expect that it's basically in line with what Qatar has been saying publicly for the last couple of weeks, which is we're prepared to negotiate, but these 13 demands that you've given us are totally unreasonable and are not really a starting point for talks.
Which gets to the key question here. What consequences does Qatar face if it does not comply?
So it remains to be seen. People I've been speaking to here among Qatari officials say they don't know, but that they're bracing for a potential round of fresh economic sanctions. So Saudi Arabia closed Qatar's only land border in early June, which has forced Qatar to start getting its food from Iran and from Turkey. And people here are saying that a next wave of economic sanctions might involve trying to target the Qatari currency, or it could involve potentially Saudi banks pulling investments, pulling deposits out of Qatar.
These are really unsettled times in the Middle East, and these are kind of drastic demands by Saudi Arabia and its allies. Is there any danger of war here?
People here think that is unlikely, but as you said, no one really knows what's going on here. Saudi Arabia has a fairly young and fairly hot-headed 31-year-old crown prince called Mohammed bin Salman, who basically led his country into this very, very bloody war in Yemen with no real plan for getting out of it. And so he's one of the wild cards in this situation.
Doesn't Saudi Arabia and its friends risk being completely humiliated if nothing happens?
Yeah, and that's one of the great fears of escalation. You know, if Saudi Arabia and its allies feel that they've lost face, if Qatar doesn't give in to each and every one of their 13 demands, then we could be heading for a pretty precarious situation where they feel like they need to escalate in order to show that they mean business. I think that's one of the big questions here. Is there a way for everybody to kind of tone this down and everybody to save face? And if not, what are the consequences?
Qatar doesn't seem to be taking any chances. It's getting military help from Turkey. How many Turkish troops are in Qatar right now, and what are they doing?
It's actually a relatively small number. Turkey opened this base last year. I think it has the capacity for sort of 5,000-ish troops, but there's a little more than 100 as far as we know right now. The United States, on the other hand, has around 10,000 soldiers at a major, major air base in Qatar. And one of the reasons Qatar agreed to allow the U.S. to station those troops there was it saw it as a hedge, that if you have a large number of American troops, you're very unlikely to be invaded by your neighbors who don't want to risk upsetting Washington. So, you know, in the extremely unlikely event that there was conflict, you know, one of the many complicating factors is you would have two different American allies fighting each other with American soldiers extremely close to the crossfire.
Raf Sanchez is with Britain's Daily Telegraph. He's in Qatar. Thanks, Raf.
Thank you very much.
Finally today, a story about a group of teenage girls in western Afghanistan. They've been offered the chance of a lifetime to participate in a robotics competition in the U.S. For months, the young engineers have been working on building a robot to enter in the first global challenge. But now it looks like they won't make it. Their parents said yes. The U.S. State Department said no. Joe Sestak is the president of First Global. Joe, have you spoken to the six girls on the team since they got the news that their visa application had been denied for the second time?
Oh, I've spoken with them several times over the past couple months, and we are saddened they won't be here. But yesterday they shipped the robot back to us. We have a group of young Afghan women here, young girls, and we will Skype in our wonderful team, our brave team from Afghanistan, and everyone will see them on the big screen watching their surrogate team represent them here.
So that's interesting. So the girls themselves, they can't come, but their robot that they created for this competition is attending, and other Afghan girls will represent the girls who can't make it from Afghanistan, the ones who were denied the visa. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, on the robot, it was curious. It sat there in customs in Afghanistan for over a month. And I finally called the ambassador's office from Afghanistan to try to get it out for the young girls. I think there was concern that the ISIS has used robotic parts before for IEDs. But in this particular case, what I do recognize, having been on the ground in Afghanistan at the very near the beginning of the war, very briefly, is that I'm very close to the situation there. And although I don't know exactly the reason for denial, I do know that there are interpreters that, with very few visas available, that have helped U.S. forces and others that are applying for these. So I can't tell you why exactly, but I do know this. A fair opportunity was given by the U.S. State Department and embassy.
I'm curious if you had any other participants in the first Global Challenge Robotics competition that were also denied visas.
It's interesting. Out of so far 158 countries that have gone through, and there's 164 nations with teams attending, so there's only a few interviews left. Only two have not gotten a visa. Iran has gotten one. Sudan has gotten one. A Syrian refugee team has gotten one. There's two.
Afghanistan, who else?
And Gambia. And visa refusal rates in both of those countries are over 70%, as you know, and very few are given in Afghanistan.
Will the Gambian team be Skyped in too?
Yes, they are. We're going to do the same for both of them.
Joe Sestak is president of First Global. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Carol, very much.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow. Hope to see you here.
PRI, Public Radio International.